All right, everyone, this is the Grey Goose, and you're listening to 91.5 WGLZ. We have our very special guest with us here on the line today. He's a 13-time PGA Tour winner, a 7-time winner on the Champions Tour, including the 2003 U.S. Senior Open. We have Mr. Bruce Leitske. No, I pronounced it wrong, but either way, we're going to keep going. Bruce, how are you today?
Walker, I'm doing just fine. It's a pretty day here in Texas, and I don't have any golf plans today, but I probably will be fishing a little bit later today, so it's a nice day here.
Wonderful, wonderful. We got ourselves our first cold spell of the season up here in West Virginia, so
it just came through Texas too, so it's our first cold front too.
Well, it is what it is. Can't blame that weather sometimes.
Walker, are you anywhere near Parkersburg?
I'm about 2 hours north of there.
I used to go to Parkersburg about 24, 25 years in a row, and I'd meet a head pro in Parkersburg named Larry Martin, and I used to do a one-man golf exhibition with him, and that was the site of my all-time lowest round of golf in my life. I shot a 60.
Oh, wow.
12 under par on the golf course, so I have fond memories of West Virginia and especially Parkersburg.
Well, wonderful. We're not too far from there, so that's really cool. Now, we're going to start off, I'd like to discuss a little bit about your background. Where are you originally from?
Born in Kansas City, Kansas, but moved to South Texas, which was Beaumont, Texas, when I was 9 years old. That was 1960. So, came from Kansas, but I consider myself a Texan since I've lived there since 1960.
Very nice. I actually just interviewed somebody from down in the Beaumont area a few weeks ago, so twice in as many weeks. Who'd have thought? How did you first get involved with golf? Who started you in the game?
It was not my dad. My dad was not a golfer, but my oldest brother is 10 years older than I am. His name is Dwayne. And he had already started caddying in golf when he was about 15 years old. And I was 5 years old, and one day he came home from the golf course from caddying, and he had customized a little golf club for his five-year-old brother. So on that day, he became my teacher. Luckily for me, he went on to be a good golf teacher. He became a club pro in Kansas. And then he became a golf salesman, but he's been the only teacher I've ever had, and it started when I was 5 years old, and I've never had another lesson from anybody for the rest of my life.
Well, hey, there you go. Once you find that teacher that you click with, just stay with it.
Well, that's what I believe. There's a lot of pros that I think have gotten in a lot of trouble. Tiger Woods is one that I think has just kind of danced around with too many people. His swing has come and gone, and so I'm definitely a believer in sticking with one teacher, and at least it worked for me. And but a lot of pros love to get advice from different teachers, so I guess I'm a little different than a lot of them.
Well, I can see your point of view too. I generally like to stick with something once I'm comfortable with it. I've had a little bit of golf experience myself, and I always find that staying with one person helps you learn a lot better.
Well, I think it does, and I guess it depends on what the results are. I mean, if you're playing terrible golf, then yeah, it's probably time to go find another teacher and work on something new. But my golf swing stayed very, very consistent through all the years that I was on the tour, so I just never felt compelled to change my golf swing, because I was hitting lots of fairways, lots of greens. The strong part of my game was ball striking. So I just never felt a necessity to work on my golf swing. The one place I could improve was putting, and that's where I did. I did get different advice, and I worked on different kind of methods of putting. But my ball striking was always good, so I stayed with the same teacher and just never got away from it.
Well, there you go. Did you play a lot of junior tournaments growing up?
I did. I started playing golf when I, like I said, when I was five and six. And I think my first tournament, I was 7 years old. at my club in Kansas. And then when I moved to Texas, the one thing I found was, boy, you can play golf year-round in the state of Texas. It wasn't that way in Kansas. I had to put the clubs away. But when I moved to South Texas, they had a great junior program. You could play all the way through Christmas. You could play through the summer. And so junior golf was a big part of my life. And I know it's the reason that I continue to pursue golf, because I was not good at other sports. I played probably every other sport for a couple of seasons each, but golf was the only, because I started at such an early age, I was better than my friends at golf because I started at such a young age. I was very average at every other sport. So my ego just kept telling me to go back to golf, and I gave up the other sports, and junior tournament golf became pretty important to me.
Absolutely. Once you find that sport you're truly good at, always stick with it.
That's what I think.
Now, did you attend college for golf?
I did. I went to University of Houston, which was only about 80 miles from Beaumont. They were one of the most famous golf programs back in the 60s and 70s, and I joined a few other guys on the team. A guy that became a professional, went on to win the British Open, Bill Rogers, was on my team. John Mahaffey won a PGA championship. Fuzzy Zeller was on my University of Houston golf team. So we had a lot of good players, and we were a good program.
Wonderful. Now, what did you get a degree from the University of Houston?
I did not. I stayed. I was there. I passed all my classes, but when the time came, it was time for me to turn pro, and I decided to put the books away and start playing golf for a living.
What year did you turn pro?
1974. I graduated college in 73, or I finished college, I should say, and then I went on the mini tours in 1974, and finally, a year later, I made it through the tour qualifying school. That was 1975, and so I've been on the PGA Tour since 75, turned pro in 74.
How long did it take you to get your first win?
It took me a year and a half. 1977 was my first win. That was in Tucson. It was the second tournament of the year. So I came out in the summer of 75, and my first tournament win was in January of 77. So about a year and a half.
Wonderful. Now, you won two Canadian Opens, so I would assume that would be one of the highlights of your time on the PGA Tour.
Well, they were certainly, any national championship is a pretty big tournament. It was on a golf course that I was real fond of, that Jack Nicklaus designed. But certainly, I'm very, very proud to have won the Canadian Open. But several of my tournament wins were here in Texas, and I guess because I'm a Texas boy, I won two Byron Nelsons, which is held in Dallas, and then I won the Colonial Championship twice, and that's in Fort Worth, and that's where I've lived in Dallas pretty much since 1985, 1988. So it was pretty cool to win PGA events in your hometown. So those two are both Colonial and the Byron Nelson are two of the highlights of my career for sure.
Absolutely. Did you have any wins that were just like completely unexpected that you just didn't see coming?
Probably one. I won at Torrey Pines. Oh, I don't know I can't remember who the sponsor these days is, but this is the San Diego tournament it's still on the PGA Tour. But it was a tournament that I had a terrible record on. It was 1981. I'd already played in probably four or five, six Torrey Pines tournaments, had played terrible, but I was going to go ahead and play again. And it was mostly just a really great last round. I think if I remember right, I just barely made the cut and played great on Saturday and Sunday, and I won in a playoff. I beat Ray Floyd and a guy named Tom Jenkins in a playoff. But that was probably the most unexpected, because it was a course that I just had never played very well, didn't really like it, didn't like the greens, but I had that great weekend, and so that was probably the most unexpected on a golf course that I just wasn't fond of.
How many events did you typically play in a season?
Well, that was probably a lower number, definitely lower than the tour average. I would say back in the 70s and 80s, the average tour pro would probably play 29 to 32 events a year, I would say would have been the average. But I had I started my family, I got married in 81, and my son was born in 83. So starting in 83, I decided to start cutting my schedule back. I didn't want to be gone all the time. I didn't want my wife to have to raise my kids, plus I wanted to be there. So I start my average, actually for my entire career on the PGA Tour, the average number of tournaments that I played for the 40 years I was out there, it was just 19. So I was on the road about 19 weeks out of the year. Most guys would play a bigger number than that, but that just turned out to be just about the right schedule for me. My favorite thing was to play about 2 or 3 weeks in a row, and that was enough. I was ready to go home, kind of recharge my batteries, and then get back out on the tour. It was my only business. I never had any side businesses. Didn't design golf courses or anything, so just playing tour golf was my livelihood. So I'd play 2 or 3 weeks in a row, and be at home for a few weeks, and then head out.
Well, that's a good way to schedule things, because if you play too much, you can get a lot of burnout, and then you play worse, and nobody wins.
I actually suffered a little bit of burnout if I did play a few too many tournaments in a row. So, yeah, I tried to avoid that, and I just needed to. And plus, when I came home, I didn't play any golf. I didn't practice. I didn't play. I just found the best way for me to play my best golf on tour was to be mentally ready to play, not burned out. So I'd go home for 2 weeks, not touch a golf club, and then I was really anxious to get back out on tour, play golf, practice as much as I needed to. And that was really important for my career, because burnout, I've seen burnout ruin many, many, many players through the years, and I just made sure I stayed away from that.
Absolutely. Now, I once read the story about you that you didn't do like a lot of practice in between when you'd be in the off season, and that your caddy had put a banana in your head cover?
Yeah, it was a new caddy. I had just hired him in the summer of 84. It was 85. It was the summer of 85, and he was not a regular traveling caddy, didn't know about me or really didn't know a whole bunch of the stuff. So at the last tournament of the year, which was the Disney World tournament in October, we finished the last round. I was unpacking my locker, and I told him to make sure that all his wet towels, any kind of rain gear that was in the car, in the bag, to take it out, because I said, you know, this is my last tournament. I won't see you again until January of the next year. And I said, man, I'm not going to touch these clubs until I see you in January. And that was about 3 months. And he didn't say anything, but he just didn't believe me. So he took a banana, put it up the head cover of my driver, didn't tell me, and sure enough, I never touched a golf club for the entire off season. About 15 weeks, I think we had off then, and it was there in January when I met him for the first tournament of 1986. There it was, and I couldn't understand what it was, but he said, "I just couldn't believe you were not going to at least go out and swing the driver in your garage or something." I said, "Nope, didn't even do that. And don't you ever do that again." And he said, yeah, he said, I won't. Please don't fire me, and I'll never stick anything else back in the golf bag. I believe you now.
That's one way to show him a lesson.
Yeah.
Now, how has the travel changed since when you first started off compared to now?
Well, it's really changed now, my early days on tour, 70s and 80s, I drove a car, and that's, I've got to say, those were my favorite years on tour. I was a bachelor for 7 or 8 years, driving in a souped-up Trans Am Firebird and single, and just traveling week to week. I got married in 81, and my wife still traveled with me for about 2 or 3 years in that Trans Am. And then the kids came along. That meant that the car was not going to work too good. So then we started having to get on an airplane and fly to the next tournament and, you know, either rent a car. So it was definitely more complicated. And these days, it has really changed. I bet probably 95% of the pros now travel by private airplane. So they don't have to go through customs and baggage inspection, and the golf clubs are pampered and don't get thrown around by baggage people. So it's a very different travel scheme these days. I'm almost certain that most of the pros they're making enough money now that they're in the private aircraft business. In my day, there were only two golfers that made enough money to have their own airplane, and it was a guy named Arnold Palmer and a guy named Jack Nicklaus. Nobody else, not even Tom Watson or Ray Floyd or any of the big names. There just wasn't enough money. We weren't making enough money to afford private airplanes except for Arnold Palmer and Jack Nicklaus.
What's funny about them is we're like centrally located right in between where both of them grew up at. Because our college is about an hour.
You are not too far from Pennsylvania and not too far from Ohio. You're exactly right, yeah.
Yeah, we're about an hour and a half from Latrobe to our east, and then to our west, Columbus is like 2.5 hours, give or take. So we're right in the middle of all this.
Yeah, you sure are, right where those two great great players came from.
Absolutely. Now, you played on the PGA Tour for a number of years, and then eventually you transitioned to the Champions Tour. Did you go over immediately once you turned 50, or?
I did, yeah. In fact, I was still eligible to play some tournaments on the PGA Tour, but as soon as I turned 50, I had played the PGA Tour for 28 straight years, and even though I was still exempt from some tournaments, I really looked forward to a little less stress. The senior tour is definitely a friendlier environment. It was players that I was much more familiar with, my age, that I played college golf against. So I looked forward to the senior tour. I turned 50 in the year 2001. And yes, as soon as I turned 50, I put the PGA Tour behind me, and I knew I was going to play probably 8 to 10 years on the senior tour. I wasn't going to go out there and play 30 weeks out of the year, because I never did that when I was on the PGA Tour, but I kept my limited schedule. I played somewhere between 18 to 20 senior events each year, and still got home at plenty of time. And the tournaments are a little shorter. They're only 3-day tournaments instead of 4. And so I went straight to the senior tour when I was eligible. Really loved my 10 years out there. And eventually an arthritic shoulder kind of just sidelined me at about the time that I was ready to quit playing anyway. But my right shoulder started bothering me, and that's when it was time just to finish the senior tour and head home. And that's what I did. In 2011 was my last competitive round, and that was the U.S. Senior Open in 2011. So I haven't played any tournament golf now in over 6 years.
Do you ever see yourself playing again?
I do not. No, my shoulder's not any better. It's not any worse, luckily. And what I can't do, I just can't play consecutive rounds of golf. If I play a day of golf, my shoulder really gets kind of tore. It feels there's no real damage in there, but the arthritis gets aggravated. So there's just no way I can play tournament golf, and I really don't even play pro-am golf or exhibition golf anymore either because of my shoulder. So no, I don't believe I'll ever play another tournament the rest of my life. And even though it's been over 6 years, I haven't I haven't missed the tournament golf at all. I have missed seeing most of my my friends that play that still play the senior tour, but I don't miss the tournaments.
Well, if you ever decide to come back, we'll all be rooting for you. So.
Well, I appreciate it. That's nice to hear.
Now, in recent years, it seems like the trend on the PGA Tour is that all the winners seem to be a lot younger compared to how it was 20, 30 years ago. But with the way the health craze is now, do you see players playing more into their 50s on the PGA Tour and legitimately contending?
Oh, that's a pretty good question. What I see is that the PGA Tour players now, you're definitely correct, they are in better shape than we were. They do get injured. I think they get injured more. Tiger, man, you can go down the list of all the injuries that Tiger has sustained, and I kind of personally believe he hasn't maintained his flexibility. He's super strong. He looks like a football player, but I think he has worked out too much on the strengthening and not enough on the flexibility. And I'm afraid a lot of the younger players are following in Tiger's footsteps. So I see him young and healthy and strong. But what I really see is and whether or not they're going to be healthy when they're 34, 36, 38. Or the other thing I see is the amount of money that they're playing for these days, whether they're going to want to continue to play golf for money when their bank account is already filled up. I just don't know if they make all the money, if they really become good players, whether they're going to have that desire to keep playing golf at 36, 38. And when they turn 50 and are eligible for the senior tour, will there be a desire to go back out and play for money? So those are kind of the concerns that I see. But there's no doubt they are in great shape. But I also think some of the workouts they do lead to some of the injuries we've seen.
Absolutely. It's going to be interesting to see the change of the guard here in about the next 10 years, because like, that's when everybody's going to be through from like the late 90s, the early 2000s. Then after that, it's going to be kind of a who knows what's going to happen.
It really is, and it's whether it's related to health or how much money. I mean, Jordan Spieth, the contracts that he's already signed, he doesn't have to play golf in 10, probably 6 or 8 years from now. If Jordan Spieth wanted to retire, he'd have enough money to do it. But what we've always seen in just about any professional sport, it's that competition. It's the urge to go out and test yourself against others. That almost never goes away. But, man, when that bank account is full, sometimes that keeps you at home a little more often. So I'm like you. I'm curious to see what this very young generation now, what they're going to be wanting to do just 8 or 10 years down the road. My generation, you knew you had to play 20, 25 years. You had to be on the tour and be a winner to make a pretty healthy living. And, boy, these days all you need is a couple of good years, and you can your bank account is full. But I think that competition keeps players working at it.
Absolutely. Now, with Tiger Woods, when he came into the game, the purses for all these tour events just went through the roof. Do you continue to see these purses rising, or do you think there's just going to be a leveling off point at some point?
I think there's going to be a leveling off. That was just as I was leaving the regular tour. Tiger came out in 96, and I was still playing a little bit on tour, but I was 40, 45, 46 years old, and so I never got to participate in those big, big purses that he started generating. But it's just I think golf has definitely in kind of it's leveled off, and if nothing else, it has even decreased in popularity, and I'm pretty sure the TV ratings are down right now. And those TV ratings are what operate, what runs, that's where the money comes from, that the tour players play for, the TV packages. And right now, it's definitely on a slow trend, so I do not see the purses increasing at all. and more of just probably hopefully staying the same. And if the ratings keep getting worse and worse, then some of those purses may get cut.
That's going to be definitely something to look out for here in the next few years.
Yeah.
So we're going to see how that works out.
Yeah.
Now, something you had mentioned earlier on in the interview was that you had come through the PGA Tour qualifying school, and that in recent years now they've really switched up the format of how that works. Do you think this new format works better, or do you think the old one was just defined the way it is?
Oh, I don't know. I hated that qualifying school. That was that's the most pressure I ever felt in golf was that qualifying school, because if you didn't finish the first school I played in, we were playing for 13 spots,
mm-hmm.
and you'd have I don't know 800 guys apply. Actually, more applied, but you had to go through these other qualifying things. But we played for 13 spots, and if you just didn't have a good week, that was your only chance for a year. If you didn't play good that week, then you'd have to. We had to go back on the mini tours, or what, you know, something like the web.com, some kind of a smaller program. But that was definitely the most pressure. Now, I think it's a fairer system now. You've got a whole mini tour system called the web.com, and you can play a year's worth of golf. You can make a little bit of money. They're not playing for a whole lot, but you can make some profit and get to all that experience that you need. So I would say this system is probably the best one. And I just know how happy I was when I made it through that qualifying school, and I never ever wanted to have to go back to it. I never wanted to lose my card, and I never did lose my card, so I never had to go back to the school. But that was just kind of a tough system that if you didn't have a good week, the week of that school, you had to wait a whole year. And man, that was, you know, at 21, you're fresh out of college, and heck, I know some guys that had already got married and had kids. And there was no place for them to play golf for a year, and guys would get club pro jobs. So there was a lot of pressure to in that qualifying school. And I was it took two tries. I missed the first qualifying school I tried in 73. I missed by one stroke, and we were playing for 13 spots, and I finished tied for 14th. And then I finally, 75 came along. We were playing for 18 spots that time, and I got in. I think I was 13th or 14th or something like that. But it was a hard system and just life or death. And I was so glad to finally get that card in my hands, and I never ever wanted to go back and do that again.
Absolutely. Now, one of the things that you had popularized while playing was a style of putting called cross-handed putting. So what exactly is that, and how did you come across that technique?
Well, when you swing a golf club, if you're a right-handed golfer, the left hand is on top of the grip, and the right hand is below that hand. That's the traditional way to strike a golf ball and for most guys to putt. My brother, the one I told you was my teacher, he had kind of worked on a system that, or he had seen from somebody else use, and the cross-handed putting style, the right hand is up on top, on the top of the club, and the left hand is below the right hand. So it's opposite of hitting the golf ball with a full swing. But a putting stroke is so much different that it doesn't really matter what the hand position was. So my brother had asked me to try that because putting was the weaker part of my game. My ball hitting was good, usually week in and week out. Some weeks I'd putt good, some weeks I didn't putt good, and I hated those weeks when I wasn't putt good, so that's when I would experiment with something. And he told me about this cross-handed putting, and I tried it. It didn't work immediately, but probably within a month I started getting comfortable with it. And so my first 17 years on tour I putted cross-handed, and I I don't want to say I was the first pro to putt cross-handed, but I do think I was one of the most successful. I think I won more tournaments than most other players putting cross-handed, and that would have been true probably until Jim Furyk came along. Jim has putted cross-handed his whole life, and I won 13 times on the tour, and I believe Jim has won, I'm going to say 18 to 19 times. So he's probably a more successful cross-handed putter than me, but for a long period, I was the most successful.
Now, what kind of advice do you have for young people looking to begin playing golf or hoping to make a career out of playing the sport?
Well, I think I get that question a lot from parents, especially, not so much kids. Kids seem to, you know, kids kind of know what they want to do. But I've had a lot of parents say, you know, how do I get my son in golf or my daughter in golf? And you really just kind of have to expose, you just have to put them on the golf course. And then I think after you expose them to golf and hopefully they enjoy it, but I think you stay away from the real intense instruction until they probably become 13, 14 years old. They need a little bit of direction and a club pro that can give a little bit of advice. But I get really nervous when I see hear a student say that he's been he's at a private academy and they hit golf balls every day and they go to school, and there's quite a few of these golf academies across the country now, and I think too much instruction, I think, can be detrimental if the child really doesn't isn't into it as much as others. And sometimes that long routine of golf instruction can really lose interest. So I kind of steer away from intense instruction. Just let the kids have fun on the golf course. Tell them, show them what the rules are and what golf etiquette is all about. And especially let them play with kids their own age. It's fine for a dad or a mom to take a child out, but eventually those kids are going to want to learn from kids their own age, and those competitive juices start happening. So not too much instruction, and just get them on the golf course, make sure they know golf rules and etiquette, and see if the golf bug bites, because it usually does.
Absolutely. Always got to practice. Practice always helps. And then when you play against people of your own age and skill level, that also helps develop you as well. So.
Well, it absolutely does. That's when you start measuring yourself and you kind of start feeding your ego. Hey, I'm a little bit better than this guy, and I'm a little bit, or he's better than me. Maybe I need to watch him. But that's how I learned in junior golf. I played against kids that were better than me and kids that were worse than me. And if you're really paying attention, you'll watch the other kids, figure out why they're better, and try to emulate what they're doing.
Absolutely. Now, something else I want to bring up is I was reading an article about you, and you were recently diagnosed with brain cancer.
Yes.
What's it been like? What's like the struggles been like? How have you been able to work through this?
Well, I'm doing just fine. So far, the treatments, well, I've had three different things happen. First, they had to do the surgery to remove the tumor. I started noticing the symptoms. It was actually the weekend of the Masters. It was April of this year. And the weekend, I started noticing, you know, a slight headache. And kind of, I was a little foggy-headed. I just wasn't making good decisions. I couldn't add a restaurant bill. I couldn't add a tip to a restaurant bill. Couldn't do just normal math. So that was something that showed up. And my wife had kind of noticed that I would say some things that were just a little different. So we went and checked out the headache and the foggy-headed thing. And almost immediately, we did an MRI. They found a tumor in my brain about the size of a tennis ball is what they thought. And it was just, we had to have surgery quickly. The brain was swelling, and and the tumor was growing at a fast rate. So the surgery was in April. That was successful. They removed, as you know, as much of the tumor as they could. I recovered from the surgery within about a month, and then it was time to start a chemo program and a radiation program that ran. They each ran for six weeks at the same time, and that was to control any spread of the cancer that might still be up there. So those were tough weeks. Just going from a perfectly healthy. I live on a ranch in Texas, and I do a lot of. That was doing a whole bunch of stuff. I do chores on the ranch all the time, and it was just kind of crazy going from a perfectly healthy 66-year-old guy to the emergency rooms and MRIs and cancer doctors and all this other stuff. But anyway, I continue on a little bit of a chemo program right now to control. If there is any cancer still up there, the chemo will control any spread. And so far, the follow-up MRIs that I've had show no spread of the cancer. So right now, the doctors are perfectly happy with the way it's going. It's been about 5 or 6 months now, and the MRIs show no extra cancer cells or anything like that. So my appetite is good. Chemo can notoriously really give you nausea and other things, but my weight is good, my blood is good. So I'm just in a recovering state of getting over this surgery. And I do still take chemo occasionally, and no more radiation. I'm done with radiation. So right now, the doctors are really happy with everything.
Well, we're all glad to hear that. We're glad to hear you're doing all right and you're just charging through it.
Yeah, going through it right now.
You talked about it. You live on a farm. So what kind of hobbies do you have to keep yourself busy?
Oh, my biggest, the one I had before, I had a collection of cars, and I've been collecting them since 1981. I bought a 67 Corvette, and through the years I've just been buying cars that I wanted when I was a teenage boy in the 60s, and so eventually it grew to 8 cars. I had a collection of 8 muscle cars, all of them from the 60s, and that's been a hobby of mine. When I did come home from a few weeks on the golf course, I would go out and work on my cars. I've always had a big garage or a barn, and that was my hobby, was working on old cars, working on the engines and wiring and a little bit of restoration work. Just before the cancer got here, I decided that it was becoming a little more of a maintenance problem of maintaining 8 muscle cars, batteries and wiring and all this other stuff. So I actually sold the collection of cars about a month before the cancer showed up. So I kind of miss working on those a little bit, but it selling the cars came at a good time. But that was my main hobby, was working on old vintage cars.
Absolutely. Was the Corvette your favorite of those models?
Yeah, I bought that in 81 from another golfer, a golfer that plays the tour from Oklahoma named Gil Morgan. And so I had the Corvette. I had a Plymouth Roadrunner from 1968. All my cars were 60s. I had 2 68 Shelby Mustangs. I had a 66 El Camino and a few others. But, yeah, they were all the Corvette was my favorite. It's the first car that I bought, and it was probably the fastest of all of them. And that was a great, great car. I miss that one more than any of the other ones.
Absolutely. Now, those are some of the best model cars that were made out of that era. So,
absolutely. Of the 60s, those were just the prime muscle cars, big engines, And I eventually those were cars that I always wanted as a high school kid. My dad wasn't going to let me have a Corvette. He wasn't going to let me have a Roadrunner or anything. So those are cars I lusted over as a high school kid. And as I made enough money on the PGA Tour and traveled around, if I would hear about or read about a car that was for sale, I just kept buying them. And I never sold any of them until March of this year. I had the Corvette for 37 years or something like that. So I've had them for a long time.
Most certainly. Now, since you're a big fan of cars, does that mean you're a fan of NASCAR?
You know, not a big fan. I am a drag racing fan. When some of those vintage cars that I had, I did do some racing work on the engine, and I'd put a set of racing slicks and exhaust and all that. But I would say the one car sport that I got interested in as a kid was drag racing, and I've actually done a couple of drag racing schools where I drove not the big nitro cars, but just some dragsters. I did Davis Love, and I did a driving school for a weekend several years ago. So I was more into drag racing. I do watch a little bit of NASCAR, but drag racing was more of an interest of mine.
As a driver, what's the fastest you've ever traveled in a car?
The dragster I drove, let's see, the fastest time was an 8.1 in a quarter mile, and the quarter mile speed I think was 185 or something like that, I believe. And we made several runs to qualify to get this kind of a license to drive. Again, not the big nitro, not those crazy top fuel cars and all that, but I did get a professional drag racer's license that would allow me to drive cars that were 8 seconds and slower. I found out that was about as fast as I wanted to go. I enjoyed that. The acceleration was fantastic. 183, 185 at the end of the quarter mile felt pretty cool. I don't believe I would get in anything any faster than that. But that was Davis Love, and I had a great time doing that school.
Absolutely. That's got to be a wonderful feeling, being able to go that fast in that short of amount of time.
It was. It was really cool, and the cars that I owned, all those, that's kind of what they were all about. They weren't about getting on the freeway and going 190 miles an hour. Muscle cars were, it was more about drag racing and acceleration in the cars in the 60s. Big horsepower, not much traction because the tires from the 60s weren't very good. So it was more about just trying to see how fast your car would accelerate. And so those professional dragsters were really real fun to drive. After having just driven street cars on the track, the dragsters were great.
Absolutely. Now, the last thing that I'm going to bring up is, you had mentioned that you're an avid fisherman.
Yeah.
When did you first start to become into fishing?
Well, that kind of came later on. The first, after I moved away from Beaumont and I was on the PGA Tour, my brother, the one that I was telling you is my golf teacher, he moved to a lake in Oklahoma called Grand Lake. And I thought, I was still living in Beaumont with my parents, and I thought it was a pretty good idea that if, now that I'm on tour, and my brother couldn't just travel to a tour event and watch me hit balls or anything. He had his own job. So I thought it was important that I move close to him, so that if I did take a few weeks off, he could see my swing and make sure he got me straightened out and all that. So when he moved to that lake in Oklahoma, I moved right next. We bought some property together, and that became my main house. And that was really the first time. I was about, I didn't really do any fishing until I was about 26, 27 years old, already on the tour. And again, I'd already bought a couple of cars. That was one of my hobbies, but I also found that I really enjoyed the fishing. It was a great way to get away from golf, forget about golf swing and traveling and the pressures of golf and all that. So the cars and the fishing became the two hobbies for me to get my mind off of golf. during my weeks off, and so they were both, I think, real important to my golf career. That I've always felt sorry for some of the pros that as soon as they played 5 weeks on the tour, then they'd come home and practice for they'd take 2 weeks off and they'd tell me that they played golf every day. And man, I'd have just absolutely gone through burnout immediately if I'd have done that. It worked. Oh, some of the great players. Tom Kite just played and plays golf, I think, every single day of his life. And that's been great for him. He's had a great career. But that would have just burned me out. So I needed hobbies, and my hobbies were cars and fishing. And then I'd be ready to go play some tour golf after I'd been fishing for a while. So it worked good for me.
Well, there you go. And you can definitely apply that to any kind of field that you're in, whether you're like a doctor or someone that's involved in anything. I mean, you have to have some sort of go away so like you have some sort of way to just relax.
I guarantee it. There's no doubt about that.
Well, Bruce, as we get ready to wrap up the interview, is there anything else you'd like our listeners to hear today?
No, I think you covered a lot of things. I'm real, real proud of my career, both senior and the PGA Tour. Hard to believe that I played, had the same job all those years. It doesn't seem like a job going out and chasing that white golf ball, but it sure was a lot of fun, and the travel was fun, and the competition was fun. So, no, I appreciate the phone call, Walker.
Well, I'm glad you could join us here today, Bruce. Thanks again for everything.
Okay, thank you.
You have a great day.
All right, you too. Bye-bye.
Bye. All right, listeners, that was Bruce Leitzke, 13-time PGA Tour winner, 7-time Champions Tour winner, and is currently in the process of kicking cancer's butt. So we are now going to get back to the music. Here is Too Many Hands on My Time by Mac Meadows, here on 91.5 WGLZ.